Everybody ready? I call to order the House Committee on Human Services on today, February 4th, 2009, and I open up an informational hearing about adoptions. Thank you, ladies. Good to see you, Nancy. Haven't seen you for a few days. Always good to see Erin.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. Erin Kelly Seal, Interim Director for the Children, Adults, and Families Division.
And I'm Nancy Keeling, the Administrator for the Office of Safety and Permanency. Morning.
Good morning.
We were asked to provide the committee today with some information about the adoption services that we provide in the Children, Adults, and Families Division, and we thank you for the opportunity to do that. On Monday, when I was here, we handed out a little fast fact sheet about what happens to children who are part of our child protection system. And at the bottom, it talks a little bit about adoption services. So we're talking now about after a child has been determined to be unsafe in their own home, they come into the legal custody of the state, and we work very hard to return children to their biological parents whenever that is possible. And if you remember, it is possible about 65% of the time. In 2007, 64% of children who were in foster care left foster care and went home to their families. When that isn't possible, then it's our job to find a permanent placement option for children. And, of course, we do not believe that foster care should be a permanent placement option for most children, and hopefully for none of them, but that's something that we're working on. We always are looking to find permanent living homes for children, and that's really where adoption and guardianship come into play for us. And in 2007, about 18% of children leaving foster care were adopted. A little over 5%, almost 6%, went into guardianship arrangements. And the adoption number represents almost 1,000 children who were adopted during 2007 in Oregon. What Nancy's going to do is just share a little bit with you about the adoption services we provide, just as part of that, some of the process, and then focus a little bit on the improvement efforts that we are making in our division to strengthen the review committee process, so how we make adoption decisions. I think this is an issue that legislators often become involved in as a result of conversations that you may have with citizens in your community, your constituents. And it's been the focus in the last year or more of some increased attention publicly and by legislators in the Judicial Department. And so we thought it would be good to spend most of our time today talking with you a little bit about the process and the decision-making process around how adoptive families are chosen. The focus for us is really about how to find a family who is in the best interest of a child. This is different from the focus of a private adoption agency that represents families who are looking to adopt. For them, the focus for that family is, can we find you a child that would fit into your family? For the state, our job as the legal custodian for a child who cannot go home safely is to focus on, can we find a family for you? And that often results in some conflict because families who are really ready and are excited about the opportunity to adopt children sometimes don't get that chance because they're not the best fit for a child in our care, and that can be really disappointing to a family. So we want to make sure that distinction's clear in terms of the state's role when it comes to adoption decision-making, what that looks like, and then after Nancy does a quick overview of those things and some improvements we're making to strengthen and make more transparent our review process, I'll talk a little bit about just how we do the work and how we're trying to improve the length of time it takes us to actually process a child through, take a child through the legal process of being adopted so that that can happen for them as quickly as possible and they're not waiting in foster care any longer than they have to.
Okay. So it's my pleasure to provide you with a brief description of the adoption program. I'm going to specifically...
I'm going to ask you to introduce yourself once more.
Okay. Thank you. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, my name is Nancy Keeling, and I am the Administrator of the Office of Safety and Permanency for Children at Children, Adults, and Families. Thank you. I'm going to specifically focus today on the adoption selection process, but there are really three stages of adoptions that the state of Oregon and specifically central office participate in for children who are in our foster care system. The first stage is ready to be declared legally free, working with the branch offices and with the courts when we are no longer able to work a reunification plan to have a child legally freed so that they can be adopted. The second is finalizing that adoption, working with the courts and with attorneys to make sure that the adoption gets finalized. And then the third is the adoption assistance program for families who have adopted very high-risk children. So those are the three areas that we focus on in central office and in the field with children in foster care. The adoption selection process is one of the issues that has been before several of you over the last couple of years. And that's the process of finding families for children in the foster care system that become free for adoption. There are really three pools of people who come forward to be considered as adoptive parents. Relatives, both relatives who had the child in foster care, and relatives who live other places, maybe even out of state, but want to be a resource for their family member. Current caretakers, generally the foster parent who have lived with and cared for the child for more than 6 months, and general applicants. Those are people from all across Oregon and other states who have completed a home study and have been approved to be considered to adopt a child. The agency's task is to find the family for the child. We're assessing the needs of the child and comparing the needs of that child with the strengths of the families who have come forward. We do that through a committee process. An adoption committee is made up of three people who have expertise in permanency and adoptions. They may be DHS employees who have no connection to the case, or they could be community partners. And those community partners are generally made up of people from the private adoption agency. Sometimes they're therapists. Sometimes they're retired professionals or adoptive parents. They're all volunteers who are trained to participate in this committee process. And a random pool is pulled every time we bring a committee together. Over the past two or three years, we've seen an increase in the number of contentious and controversial committees, and many of you have had calls in relation to those contentions, and you're all smiling at me, so most of you have had calls. So what changed? DHS put more emphasis on seeking and finding relatives to provide for their family members. Foster parents can become current caretakers with equal status to that relative after only 6 months. Therein lies the conflict. It becomes the tension between the child's right to grow up in their family of origin or with their siblings and the attachment and bonding that's occurred between the foster family and the child that's been living with them, sometimes for more than two or three years. So as you can imagine, this becomes very emotional and heart-rending. There are often situations that your constituents call you about, and the good news is there are two families who want this child or these children. The task before the adoption committee is to gather all the information, to hear from the adoption workers, the CASA, the child's attorney, any therapists that are involved, and any others that have assessed the specific needs of the child or children and recommend the family that best meets that child's needs. As you can imagine, this does not always go smoothly, and at times it even plays out in the media. In an effort to assess and improve our process, we contacted the National Resource Center on Adoptions about 2 years ago and asked them to come out and take a look at our committee process and make recommendations. And they did that. And at about the same time, Dr. Goldberg convened a sensitive review committee on a very high-profile adoption case, and that committee also made a number of recommendations. We have been able to put the recommendations from the National Resource Center and from that sensitive review committee together to make some significant changes in our adoption process. The folks who were on the sensitive committee became so interested in the process that I believe through Representative Krieger's leadership, we engaged the Chief Justice, several state legislators, and several judges to come together with Dr. Goldberg, with Aaron Kelly Seal, and myself. And we've met three times now. and made some very significant recommendations to improve the adoption selection process. For me, it's very exciting to see the three branches of government focusing on one topic at one time. It was a first, so I enjoyed that very much. They recommended revising the form that we document the adoption committee process on. Many people who have looked at those forms in contentious kind of situations have said, we can't tell when we look here how the committee got to the resolution that they got. So we readjusted the form so that when a committee meets now, the first thing they do is focus on the child and the child's needs. Then they look at the families, and then they put those things together, and then they document how it is they came to the decision that they have come to. The most significant change or recommendation that this committee made was to open up the process to the legal parties. Presently, when an adoption committee meets, after people present information, they're asked to leave while the committee deliberates. We've now made the decision that the CASA, the child's attorney, and the tribal representatives will be able to stay in the room while the adoption committee deliberates and comes to a recommendation. It's our hope that this transparency will make an impact on the conflicts, and people will be able to see how decisions are made. Last session, the legislature gave DHS a very clear direction to make diligent efforts to give preference to relatives when placing children for foster care or adoption. The current 6-month time frame for current caretakers makes that very difficult. House Bill 2050 has been introduced to address this problem, and you'll be hearing about that, I think, later today.
So I'll summarize just a few other pieces of information that I think may be helpful and put some context around this. Every year, or last biennium, there was $144 million spent on through the state on adoption services. The majority of that money, 89% of it, was paid out in the form of adoption assistance or supports for adoptive families. We support in the last year we supported over 11,000 children who have been adopted through adoption assistance. I think that Nancy did a really great job of summarizing our efforts over the past year in consultation with experts as well as many legislators in the judicial branch to try and make the review process more transparent. Some of the contention that has arisen in the past has been because we heard a lot about people really not understanding the decision-making process and the considerations that were weighed, and there was a sense that people weren't making or considering the right things. And so by opening up the process, by having a more comprehensive form that gets filled out when reviews are requested, it allows us to be able to explain better, I think, what happens in an adoption review proceeding and what information they considered. I think you also received some statistical information about adoptions and review committee information in advance of today's hearing. It looks like that, well, I think yours is two-sided. I'm sorry I wasn't paper sensitive here with my printing out. But it gives out some of the information I've already shared with you. But I think it's also really important to point out that when we looked back over a 3-month period at the number of cases that were reviewed, and again, just trying to keep in context that sometimes the public dialogue about our work is really representative of a very small percentage of the work that we do. And over a period of about 36 months, or so 3 years, we were only requested to review 66 adoption decisions. That's a very... that's really a small percentage. If you think about, on average, we review about we'd make 1,000 decisions per year. So 66 over a 3-year period requests for review were made. And it's also noteworthy, I think, to point out that 26 of those cases, and remember, this was really just only 6 months of that time frame, followed the legislative direction around diligent efforts for relatives. And that's not to say we hadn't always been making efforts around relative placements, but clearly the policy direction was you need to make even more efforts than you're currently making. But 26 of those cases involved relative versus non-relative current caretakers, in other words, foster parents who had to, had been caring for a child for at least 6 months. Not every case that in which a review is requested do we grant a review. And the focus of a review at the central office level is not based, it's not a de novo review. So in other words, we don't re-review all of the factual information and try and make an independent decision about whether or not the committee decided that the family the committee decided is in the best interest. What the focus of the review at the central office level is on did the committee consider the right information? Were they qualified to make the decision that we were asking them to make? And did they focus their decision on the best interest of the child as opposed to, say, the desire of the family? But it is a very difficult review to make, and Nancy and I have both participated in those, and the decisions in these cases that get to that point, the request for review, a small percentage of them are very, very difficult because, as Nancy pointed out, they often involve cases in which a child who is in foster care has been with a placement for some period of time, has a connection or what we call an attachment to that placement, and then there is a relative in some of these cases, someone with a biological connection to the child who we're having to decide between. Please.
One of the most common questions that people ask is, well, why didn't you place with the relative in the first place? And the reason for that is that the very first plan that we, by law, are required to make, except in very, very rare cases, is a reunification plan with the parent. And so during the first few months, while the parent is seeking and getting into treatment and we're identifying the issues of the case and kind of developing the plans, our plan is to have reunification. So we're doing visitation with the parent and we're doing everything that we can to get to that point. If I'm a nana and I live in Idaho, the child can't come and live with me during that process. And so foster parents who are by designed to be temporary resources come forward and provide a loving home for that child during that time period. What happens then, though, as things stretch on, before we get to the point where the court moves the case to a permanent plan, the child may have been there for a long time. Often relatives come and visit, and they talk on the phone frequently, and they try to develop a relationship with the child, but we can't actually move them in with the relative until we have stopped doing the reunification plan if they're not within a good proximity.
So just to also continue on this page, of those reviews involving the relative versus the current caretaker over that 36-month period, you'll see on the page that 11, well, we granted review in only 16 of those cases. And so that what that meant is that at the central office level, we determined that procedurally it was appropriate to review the case. And in 11 of those, the current caretaker, the decision was upheld to that. And basically, so I always have to choose my words carefully here because it sounds like we're finding in favor of someone, but what we're really doing is saying that the current caretaker was the placement option that was in the best interest of the child. And in 3, we upheld the selection of a relative. And in only 2 of the cases that were reviewed was the decision of the Adoption Review Committee changed. And it went both ways. After we do a central office administrative review, the parties also have the option of seeking judicial review of an adoption decision. And that doesn't happen very often, as you can see. Only 6 in that 36-month period went before the court. 4 of the 6 were upheld. 1 was referred back to the agency for reconsideration, and only 1 case in a 3-year period was reversed. So it just puts into perspective, I think, the conversation that we often end up spending a lot of time having, and it's appropriate because they are the hardest decisions, but those that are the decisions that end up being challenged or the decisions in which we have really difficult, we're in a difficult position as an organization and as an agency. So the last thing I want to do, trying to honor the time we were given, is just get you up to speed a little bit on how we've been working to improve our adoption process. As Nancy mentioned, there are really 3 major phases of work that are involved for us that involve both a local work at the local level in our branch offices, work at the central office level, work with our court partners and the parties. It's complicated. But we in order to be adopted, a child first has to be declared legally free. And basically what that means is that we have to be certain that we have done everything the law requires us to do with respect to the parents' rights in that case and the child's rights in that case before we can look for and find another permanent placement option for the child. And in the past, in our worst case, I mentioned this before, I think, that process, which is very cumbersome and paper intensive and involves a lot of legal review, has taken us between 200 and 400 days in our worst case scenario. So that's time of almost a year that we know a child isn't going to go home, that we know we want to be looking for a permanent adoptive placement, and sometimes we've actually found the placement, but the paperwork is holding up the process. We did a review of our paperwork process around declaring a child legally free for adoption. And we have revised the process so that going forward, once we've fully implemented everything, we've already started to take the steps we need. There are a couple of technology pieces that we still need to bring online. But we believe we can reduce that time on average to 45 days. That's a huge change for us and will make a huge difference in these cases and in the lives of these children. We also did a process improvement review around what it takes to finalize an adoption. And again, this is so once an adoptive placement has been found, and then there is paperwork for us that is legal and again very involved in terms of the number of people that are involved with us at the local central office and in all of the legal proceedings. And before, we found that it could take us anywhere from 60 to around 150 days to just finalize the adoption. Well, that also can be excruciating. I've spoken with some families that have had a child placed in their home. So at that point, the child usually is in the home of the adoptive resource. But they're waiting. They want it to be final. They want an end to the experience, which I really, frankly, don't blame them. They really, want to move on. And so we've looked at our process, and we believe that we actually can reduce, on average, the time it takes to finalize an adoption to 2 weeks from that 60 to 150 days. So that will also make a big difference, and we're really looking forward to that. And then finally, as Nancy mentioned, we do provide support for children in adoptive placements when those children have extraordinary needs. It's not enough support, but it's something in addition that an adoptive family and a child can have benefit them. And this is a contractual arrangement between the state and the adoptive resource, and it's in the form of adoption assistance. But that, too, takes time in terms of negotiation and finalization. This is a less impressive statistic, but on average, it's taking us right now about 27 days to get that adoption assistance paperwork through the process, and we think we can get that down to 14. So when you add up the total number of days that we will be really peeling off this entire process time, it's pretty significant in the lives of kids who are being adopted, and we're really excited about the opportunity to implement those changes and do the work better. So again, we're open to taking any questions, but appreciate the opportunity just to share with you some of the work that we do around adoption. We could probably talk with you for many, many hours about this topic, but wanted to just hit a few highlights.
Thank you so much. I was on that sensitive review committee, colleagues, as were a couple of our colleagues in the back and another one who will be coming. And it was one of the most informative situations in which I've ever been. And I was so impressed with the ability of the staff to be open to our concerns and to suggestions and how improvements can be made. Representative Maurer was there also.
Can't talk about it, ma'am.
Pardon?
Can't talk about it, ma'am.
I'm just referring to the globe. That's what I told him last evening. So anyway, I thank you so much, and thanks again for all the work that you've done in this and the incredible improvements you've made, even since we last spoke. This was great.
Madam Chair, I do have a question.
Sure.
And it's for Aaron. When do you expect full implementation of this reduction in processes?
Actually, I might defer to Nancy. She's been more in touch with the administrative work on this and the schedule for it. Do we have a final timeline?
We don't have a final timeline.
You know, I'll Chair Tomei, Representative Maurer, I will contact our transformation lead and make sure we get that to you. One of the exciting things, I know this is a little bit outside the protocol, but we have hired a new adoptions manager. She started Monday, and we had a period of time in which we had someone in that position for the last 3 or 4 months or so who was really only half-time, and we've been recruiting actively for the position and trying to fill it. So it's very exciting for us to have come on up, Beth. Would you mind? Do you mind if Beth introduces herself to you and the committee? Because I think you may, in the future, not be hearing from Nancy and I on these subjects, but really hearing from Beth. And you may recognize Beth because she has been doing this work. She did this work in Oregon before.
Chair Tomei and members of the committee, I'm Beth Englander, and it's a pleasure to introduce myself to you this morning. I previously worked in Oregon. I was a field manager, starting back with the Old Children's Services Division in Coos and Curry counties. And prior to leaving Oregon, I was the system of care manager for the department, briefly the child protective services manager. And in the last 6 years, I spent 4 years as the director of child welfare in Florida. And then I managed a national, project that supported the Children's Bureau Child and Family Services Review project and program. It's a pleasure to be here, and I look forward to being in front of you in the future.
We're happy to have you here. But, Nancy, I feel a lot of sadness that we're losing you. The whole state will have a loss when you leave. Thanks for all that you've done all these years. Whatever we threw at Nancy, she very calmly could answer everything and was just terrific. So thank you. Any further questions? Oh, you're being nice and gentle this morning. All right. Thank you so much.
Gentle.
Yes, gentle. You're still asleep, aren't you? I'm closing the informational meeting on adoptions, and I would sure hope that you ladies would be kind enough to stay. And Mickey, it's good to see you too. We're opening up a public hearing on House Bill 2050. And Representative Krieger, are you going to come up and present the bill to us? That would be great. But go ahead, Keeley.
Okay, the purpose of this bill is to extend the timeline to establish a caregiver relationship between a juvenile and an unrelated foster parent from 6 months to a full year.
Great. And Representative Shostak.
Thank you.
And I think we're going to be having Senator Cruz here also.
Okay.
That would be a trio.
Madam Chair. Yeah, it is. Quite a trio. Madam Chair, Mike Schoffler, State Representative, House District 48, Happy Valley, out of Southeast Portland. And my friend to my left here is, let me go first because I'm chairing Business and Labor right next door and we're working bills right now. So I'll be very brief. I was invited to participate by my friend Wayne Krieger in the sensitive review, the first one before the last one we were on. And you're right, it has been incredibly informative. Even though it is a very painful subject matter, it's something we need to do to protect the most vulnerable in this state, and I'm honored to be here and testify in favor of this bill. Through many of the things we discussed, things that came to light, clearly this extension from 6 to 12 months is needed. I'm convinced it's a good bill, should pass. One thing I do have to say, though, is I have one very active, vocal foster parent who has done a tremendous job over the years, her and her husband, Louise Calder, taking care of children that have been shaken to the point where they need incredible, far more needs than a parent like me could even take care of. God forbid that ever happened to my little baby. But she was voiced concerned about that the department make sure, if we go ahead and do this, that we still pay close attention to those foster parents, even though they don't have standing until after 12 months. And I'm sure we all, because they're right there at ground zero, doing the Lord's work, and I'm confident the department will listen to that and take that into consideration. So it's a good bill. It's fun to be with these guys. They're great to work with, as are you, Madam Chair. And I'm going to excuse myself if that's okay with you.
Absolutely. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
For coming.
And keep up a good work.
Representative Krieger, do you want to talk a little bit about how we reached this point? Maybe the two of you could do that.
Yeah, Madam Chair. For the record, it's Wayne Krieger, State Rep, District 1. And I do want to talk a little bit about the bill, cover a few more things that DHS did cover, but maybe from my viewpoint of how it started and this type of thing. But the need for House Bill 2050 really came about as a result of the second look of the policies of the department and the consequences of allowing a caregiver relationship to exist after 6 months and intervener status be put into place. Before I go on the bill, I wanted to talk to you just a little bit about the original work group clear back from 2007 that took something in the neighborhood 14 to 16 months. We had the 10 bills that we passed off the House floor out of committee unanimously everywhere. You know, Senator Cruz was there, Representative Shaw, or myself, Senator Kate Brown, and we're hoping that possibly Senator Schrader will be joining that group now. I know Representative Cruz, I think, has talked to her, and I think she'd be a great addition. We've got some more work to do, and we're in the process of doing that. Specifically about the adoption committee process, the home studies, and the work group that was put together, where we had legislators, we had judges, and we had Dr. Goldberg and his staff. So you had all three branches of government, as you heard, sitting around the table. You were there. Senator Cruz was there. And those were good experiences. I mean, we learned things there. And I thought, because you know, what was really great about it, there's no politics. You're doing what you need to do because it's something that needs to happen. And we deal with the problem, and you don't have to deal with the politics, which sometimes in this building can be difficult. The Chief Justice, I contacted him some time back, and I had talked to you the other day because there is going to be another work group looking at a broader set of issues, and we'll be starting up probably in the next couple weeks. I wanted to make sure that the committee understood that we changed that relationship from 6 to 12 months in 2005 because we thought we were going the right direction. And after the two sets of review committees, we looked at this issue as part of the DHS case reviews. And talking to Mickey Cerise from the department, I hadn't realized that we actually, at one time, it was 30 months, then it went to 18 months, then it went to 12 months, then it went to 6 months. So there was a trend going there. And now we're back asking to go back to 12 months before that caregiver status is in place. And also, as you heard in 2007 under Senate Bill 414, we required DHS to make a diligent effort to locate relatives. And this was a change from reasonable effort. And that in itself can take more time. And also, as you heard in 414, that relatives should be given a preference for adoption care placement. It's often difficult to locate relatives within that 6 months, during which time the foster parents achieve and establish a caregiver relationship and actually compete for the child. And part of the problem arises when foster parents look at providing of care for a foster child as the first step to adoption. As you heard, they are being better instructed or understand that that is not there to take care of that particular child, and it isn't the first step to adoption. In some cases, it may be, but originally, that's not what it is. The bill would simply require that foster parents to have providing care for 12 consecutive months before gaining this status. This whole issue of foster kids, as you know, is very emotional. I've had 12 foster kids over the years, my wife and I. The older one would be 45 now. He's passed away. But you get attached to those kids, and I can see how that can happen. And, you know, and you have a baby in your house for 4 or 5 months, and then maybe it's time for that child to move on. You have to be able to deal with that. So that's just not an easy deal, and I understand that. But I think going to 12 months now that we understand that the recovery programs often take more than 6 months, The due diligence takes more than 6 months sometimes. So I think getting back to the 12 months is probably where we need to be, and hopefully we won't be dancing around on that issue anymore.
Thank you so much, Representative. Thanks for coming. Senator?
Thank you, Madam Chair. For the record, Jeff Cruz, Senate District 1. It's been a privilege to be part of this work over time, and actually I started on the adoption process back in 97, so I've been at this for a good period of time. I don't want to go over anything that the previous speakers have said. I guess my main reason for being here is to know that we are connected on both sides of the building on this issue, and as we were during the last session, and we will be going forward. We'll be convening here relatively soon to start the next phase of this work. And just so there's no confusion, Senator Schrader is Senator Martha Schrader. And I have talked to her about that, and she is very excited to be part of this work and will bring a really good perspective as a former county commissioner to the work we're doing. And I've also had a conversation with Secretary Brown as to whether she would like to continue in the group. She said let her think about it for a few days. There's two aspects of it. She initially thought we were talking about the legal side of things, which gets into the work of the Law Commission. And I said, no, we're looking at the structural side of things. And so hopefully she will be willing to participate, because she brings a vast knowledge base to the subject area herself. So I'm glad you're going to be involved, Madam Chair. It's not an exclusive club by any stretch. Obviously, it stresses some of the members, because Representative Schaffler was clean shaven when we started all this. So I don't know if that's cause and effect, but there it is. So I just urge passage of this. We're looking forward to getting the bill on the Senate side, and I want to thank you for being willing to step up and get this and get it early in the session.
Great. Thank you, Senator Cruz. Any question of this panel?
No. Madam Chair, it's a comment. I mean, of all the things that we deal with, I mean, this is at the heart of the hardest thing that we have to deal with. And, you know, changing a number on a piece of paper is easy to do structurally, process-wise, but the impacts are significant. And, you know, we will never stop visiting this issue, because it will constantly come back up. And it's, you know, all I can say for the new members is, if you have an opportunity to participate, do so, because it's very eye-opening. I don't have foster children. I haven't. And I applaud those that do, Madam Chair, Representative Krieger, and anybody else on here that has. So.
Yeah. Madam Chair, just a comment. Representative Maurer, you're right. I mean, when we started out and Representative Krieger spoke to the time frame way back when and how we've compressed it, and you know, in all good intention, we went too far. Okay, but we didn't know that until we get some experience on the ground as to what the real impacts are, and so we're making an adjustment again. And quite honestly, we can be absolutely perfect here and get it wrong. And, you know, if something we think is right isn't always right. So it will be ongoing work. But, I mean, when we went to 6 months, we thought that was the perfect solution. And as it turns out, the experiences showed us that that's not true. Plus, the dynamics in the system are changing. You know, Representative Krieger spoke about the parents that are going into treatment. Well, even at 12 months, you don't know what the results are going to be. But at 12 months, you can have a clue as to the track they're on. So, and in 6 months, you just can't do that. So I think this is an appropriate adjustment, and we hope it works.
And I guess I want to point out, too, you sort of touched on this, that this bill was the only legislation that came out of that committee. But obviously, from the previous testimony, we know that there were many things that were changed in the department that were tremendous improvements that they were so eager, to work with us on, that. I mean, this is just the tip of the iceberg of what came out of those meetings that we had that Representative Krieger put together with
Madam
the justices.
Chair, a lot of what needed to do was simply either administrative rule change or policy of the department, and then that filters down through the staff and becomes, you know, that's how we do things.
Right.
One thing I didn't mention on was the department, when they testified, talked about, I think, 66 appeals on placements. You got to understand that a lot of these foster kids are not being given attorneys or legal help when they need it early on to protect their interests, and some things have gone astray as a result of that. Also, I don't think there's a legislator can't tell you a horror story where families ended up, they're broke. The system broke them before they could ever get to an appeals process. They didn't have an attorney to go in and represent them. So that's one of the types of things we're going to be looking at in this other group, and that's why we've asked the Chief Justice to help us and bring some judges in and some attorneys that have represented families and kids to take a look at the process.
Yeah, Madam Chair, out of the whole package of bills we did last session, that was the one that we left on the table was because it had dollars attached to it, and it went to Ways and Means and disappeared. And we were asking, I think, at that point for $24 million to make sure these kids do have representation in most cases, but it's not adequate representation. If you have a lawyer that has your case that sees your file 30 seconds before they go in the courtroom, that's not adequate representation. So, and this was a request not only from the judges, but from the DAs as well, because anybody in the legal system will tell you that if both sides aren't adequately represented, your case is going to have problems. So, and we just thought one of the fundamental things, and we're still going to fight for it, although in this budget situation, probably not successfully, but all the kids in the system should have good representation. We have CASAs, and CASAs are great, but they're not lawyers. And in many cases, we find caseworkers trying to do legal work, and that's not their job. And so we're trying to make sure that they're doing the job of a caseworker, and we have somebody doing the job of a lawyer representing the kids.
Thank you. Any questions of these folks? Representative Van Orman.
Thank you, Chair Tomei. I think basically I probably have more of a comment than a question. I've estimated that I have worked for 7,000 children over the years. And in Head Start, foster children are automatically eligible to be in Head Start. And so I've seen many cases, many varieties of circumstances for these children. And the bottom line is, really, what is best for the kids, and how can we expedite this as quickly as possible? Because we are affecting young people's lives, and it's a serious effect.
Thank you. Representative Cowan.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I too have been a foster parent, but that goes back to the 80s, and there's been a tremendous improvement in the system over some of my experiences, and I appreciate that. I think the one question that I'd appreciate your feedback on is whether in the process of the discussion there was any consideration to having that 12-month time period be perhaps different depending on the age of the child in care. I'm thinking about the imprinting that happens with a very young child as opposed to an older child in the system.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, there had been a little of that, but the two things that were the emphasis was the length of time for the parents to recover and be able to reunite the family, and then the fact that, I've lost my train of thought here, but we didn't want to put the caregiver in that position of having that until that status, until the requirement of due diligence took place, and those two are the driving thing. Now, you know, I've had six kids. I've got 17 grandkids and 12 foster kids, and every neighbor in the neighborhood been up on the ranch for 30 years. And though some of these kids have been very affected, you know, abused, a lot of loving care in the home, out of the home, or anywhere can be a huge value, but they adapt quite rapidly to love when they get to that home, wherever it is.
Madam Chair, Representative Cowan, you do bring up a good point, and it's something we have discussed. Should the standards be different, and should the way we handle cases be different for infants as opposed to older children? Because if we are looking at the best interest of the child, their initial bonding is a critical element of this. And it is something that we've talked about and will consider, but not for this particular piece. But I think out in time, that's certainly an issue that I have a great deal of concern about.
Representative Boone.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me, and my memory is not always great, but it seems to me in 2005 when I was on this committee, that there, and Ways and Means, there was an effort to provide paralegals so that the caseworkers wouldn't have to try to be the lawyers. Are you aware of whatever happened to that?
I'm not.
Madam Chair, Representative Boone, I don't recall that discussion. I remember the discussion specifically of the need for representation earlier, right from the very beginning. And the Chief Justice had talked to the group, had talked to our work group and to Speaker Menace the value of having that caregiver or that representation, the attorney right up front, and that it probably would save time, save litigation, and make sure that everybody, both the department, and the system, worked more efficiently and more fairly.
Erin, I think you have something to tell us.
Chair Tomei, Representative Boone. Erin Kelly Seal, for the record, with the Children, Adults, and Families Division. I think it will be worthy of an additional hearing, a conversation about legal representation in these proceedings, because these proceedings are very unique. They're civil proceedings, and there are many people involved in them. And from the conversation that has been happening that you, I think, are remembering, Representative Boone, has really focused on the fact that Oregon is one of the few states in the country in which child welfare workers, the state, are not represented in court. And this has really two impacts. One, it at every step of the way. So there are some cases in which the Attorney General is present for those hearings, and others in which the caseworker is primarily responsible for litigating a case. And so the legislature between 2003, 2005, and 2007 has made a concerted effort to improve the kind of review that takes place legally by the Attorney General's office, as well as the quantity of representation for the state. What the good representative and senator are referring to is bringing some balance to that effort. It is true that in all of these cases, attorneys are made available to parents and children, but I think the dynamic that they have really done an excellent job of bringing to the forefront is that many of the attorneys who represent parents and children in these cases do so under extraordinary conditions. They have significant caseloads that are almost unmanageable that really preclude them from spending a concerted period of time on these proceedings, and the rate that they are paid often impacts their caseload issues. They need to take on more cases in order to make a living, and also, quite frankly, even their willingness to take these kinds of cases. So there are several dynamics here around legal representation, as well as just the positions that each of these lawyers is taking. The district attorneys also play a role in these cases in many counties. They represent the state before legal custody is granted to the child welfare, to the state. And so it's a complex set of legal issues, and I really appreciate the continued attention of the legislature to it. But, yes, progress has been made in terms of representation and legal review for DHS staff, which is helping us, I think, serve kids better, but also reducing the amount of time that a caseworker who is not trained in legal work is required then to be spending on court documents and court proceedings.
Colleagues, I'm going to stop this part of the discussion because it really is not totally pertaining to this issue. So it is fascinating, but we have people who are wanting to speak on this bill. So unless you have any more questions, We're going to move on. Thank you so much. Thank you. Appreciate you coming. Okay, Brian Baker and Danland, is that correct? Darland, okay, and Kevin George. Is there anyone else besides these three who would like to speak today? Okay, and colleagues, I just want to point, well, we have to leave here.
It starts at 9:45.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you for coming. So whoever, I think Brian wrote down his name first.
Okay. Chair Tomei, members of the committee, thank you for this opportunity to speak today. I traveled down today. My name is Brian Baker. I'm a staff attorney with the Juvenile Rights Project in Portland, Oregon, and we are a children's law firm practicing in juvenile court. I've been a children's attorney for approximately 15 years, and so many of the issues that you've heard this morning I deal with on a daily basis. I came down today to raise some concerns about the change in the caregiver definition from 12 months to 6 months. Most importantly, Juvenile Rights Project would like to see to maintain flexibility in the permanency process. The committee heard some of the data this morning, approximately 1,000 adoptions on a yearly basis. 75% of those adoptions are with individuals who have a pre-existing relationship with that child, either as relative providers or as non-relative providers, but they've been involved in that child's life. And of those 75%, 32% are related caregivers and 38% are non-related caregivers. It takes approximately 33 months to achieve permanency for children in the system. And I think our biggest concern is if we change the definition from 6 to 12 months. And as the committee heard today, we've really grappled with this for many years, and the period of time has changed, it's decreased. There are many, many factors that impact that 33 months of why it takes that period of time to achieve permanency. Sometimes difficulty getting services for biological families. The court is always made aware of these circumstances and has flexibility around when to decide to change the permanency plan from reunification to other permanency. And so if a family's been denied the right or had difficulty accessing services, additional time can be granted. We would like to keep as much flexibility for permanency planning, whether that's with relatives or with non-relatives. And that's our biggest concern with the change to 12 months, that will perhaps create longer periods of time to achieve permanency for children. As Representative Cohen asked earlier, are there differences for younger children or older children? Most definitely, there are differences in attachment, and that would be another aspect of trying to maintain flexibility in this process. If I could take any questions, otherwise I will pass it to Mr. Darlin.
Any questions of this witness?
I don't want my earlier question taken out of context. I was just curious about whether that was considered. I'm wondering if you could just sum up in a sentence. From your perspective, I understand about the timing. We've talked a lot about timing going through the system, but what's wrong with 12 months?
Representative Tomei, Representative Cohen, I think the concern is if that potentially creates a longer period to achieve permanency. When a non-relative... I'm sorry. I don't know if I can do it in a sentence.
Well, all right. I won't limit you to just... I mean, specifically, I'm trying to figure out from all of what you've described where in there the problem with 12 versus 6 is, and I wondered if you could help me get my brain around that kind of simply.
Well, Representative Colwin, I think the one thing to point out is when a non-relative provider seeks intervention status, they do that for many different reasons, not necessarily just to pursue permanent placement with him or her. Part of it can be to be a more active party to the juvenile court case, to give information to the court, to have access to information, evaluation information as they're advocating for the child, to meet the child's best interests and meet the child's needs. The issue around flexibility with the court and allowing that intervention status is that the court will always keep the best interests of the child in mind, and by allowing that non-relative provider that access at an earlier junction, the court has another potential resource available for the child, and that flexibility. I guess ultimately, to look at each individual case, at each individual child's needs, their attachment, their age, and to factor all of that in. But as the committee has heard today, there are many different factors that impact permanency, and I'm very pleased to hear about the agency's efforts to improve the agency's work towards permanency. Court practitioners, we equally are working diligently to decrease those periods of time to reach permanency. Juvenile Rights was very active in the planning for Senate Bill 414 and requiring diligent search for relatives. We absolutely would make ourselves available to be involved in further discussions if there are difficulties within the agency's process in identifying relatives or conducting that diligent search, potentially through rulemaking, for example, to be part of that.
Thank you, Mr. Baker.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
Could I just follow up? I appreciate your argument, Mr. Baker, in the abstract, you know, for flexibility, but it would help if you could give us a couple of concrete examples of where, you know, extending this to 1 year would create a hardship.
Chair Tomei and Representative Denver, I think an example, as I was driving down and trying to come up with examples, part of this is we know that children have a lot of mobility within foster care, anywhere from 2 to 8 placements. So children are landing in foster placements at different times vis-a-vis the extent of time that they've been in the system overall. So you may have a child that's getting closer to that determination that permanency is necessary, that it's not going to be reunification with the biological family. And so as an example, that foster parent who might be the third or fourth foster parent, they are providing care for that child. Let's say they reach that six-month mark, and at that six-month mark, we're actually 12 months or 18 months into the case or 24 months into the case. It's clear that it's not going to be returned. A bond has been formed. You know, hopefully in an ideal world, while the child's been there and that relationship is forming, everyone has worked diligently to look for relatives, to look for that grandmother out of state, to identify if there's a relative provider. However, that, you know, often, as we can see from the statistics, it's about even as to whether or not a child will be with a relative or with a non-relative. And so that's a circumstance where that individual may decide at that six-month mark, I feel this commitment to this child and want to present to be that permanent resource. Now, just because intervener status is acquired, that doesn't mean necessarily that the court's going to make that non-relative provider the permanent resource, but it provides a step forward and access to the decision-making process for that permanency decision. I hope that provides an answer.
So the child could have been in the system as much as, 2 years or perhaps longer at this point?
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Mr. Darling, we're going to move on to you, make sure that you have a chance to speak. And I know I hadn't noted it before that you did drive more than 100 miles. Could you introduce yourselves?
Oh, did I check the wrong box?
Oh, you did say that, but that's okay.
I'm sorry.
However far you came, if it was
I'm
around
sorry,
the block,
I live in
that's
Siam.
Just fine. That's okay.
Good morning, Chair Tomei and committee members. My name for the record is Don Darland. I'm the president of the Oregon Foster Parent Association and been a foster parent for approximately 18 years. And my wife and I have taken care of somewhere around 50-plus children, and we have not adopted. Well, we have not adopted formally. They continue to return and ask for money, so. thank you. It's good to see my friend Representative Olson here this morning. Nice, wide-eyed, and bushy-tailed. And thank you for allowing me to come. I'll make it very brief. You have my written testimony. In 2005, when Senate Bill 815 passed, which was the Foster Parent Bill of Rights, and it also changed Statute 419 Bravo to read 6 months instead of 12 months, which you're considering to change back to 12 months. One of the main reasons that we as foster parents at that time wanted this changed was not necessarily toward having some current caretaker status or adoption. I had some families who at the time they felt if they could have intervened at 6 months and became a better voice in court, even though federal law and state law allows foster parents a right to be heard in court, a limited participation. And I personally recommend to foster parents all the time, just exercise your right to be heard. You don't necessarily need intervener status because that's really what they want, is to be heard. Sometimes that just isn't the option, or for whatever reason they don't get that option or whatever. So this family, or there was two families that felt if we could have intervened at 6 months and really become advocates for this family, these two boys could have went back to dad a little sooner. Now, they weren't advocating to have those boys in their home. They were very close to the family, still going to do daycare for that family. But they were going to try, I mean, they felt that they could have got these two boys back to dad sooner and helped him advocate through the system. Because, as we already heard testimony, sometimes the legal representation for children and even these bio families could be a bit inadequate. Unfortunately, it happens. So at that time, our major, at least my major focus was, you know, here's another party to the case, to advocate for the children and families. Doesn't necessarily mean they're going to have the children in their home. So that was one of the purposes there. The other thing is, as I read policy, and if I understand policy, and I'm sure Mr. George will straighten me out, he normally does, that they can change current caretaker status back to 12 months without changing the statute. That's my understanding, although he'll correct me if I'm wrong. So current caretaker status could be changed without the statute change, if I'm understanding right. So with that, I really neither for or against, kind of, why change it? Why spend the money? Just change the policy. Thank you very much, Chair, to many committee members.
Thank you. It seems that you're asking a question. Maybe we will have Mr. Kevin George answer, and then if we have questions of these two, we can do that. So, thank you.
Good morning, Chair Tomei, members of the committee. My name is Kevin George. I work as the foster care program manager over the Department of Human Services at Children, Adults, and Families, and it's good to see some of you yet again this week. What I want to do first is acknowledge Representative Schaffler and Cruz, Senator Cruz and Representative Krieger. And either it's been through a lot of hard work and diligent work between the legislature and our department to come to really a consistent thought process and consistent advocacy process, because that really is what has formed a lot of this kind of work that we've done. In addition to, I was sitting back there thinking that they got my testimony and read it to you already, because most of mine parallels exactly what they were saying. So that's, I think, a good sign showing us that we are getting all on the same page with legislative direction for us. So I have submitted written testimony, and I'm just going to highlight a few areas that may have not been covered in previous testimony. And first, I would say, yes, Mr. Darlin is correct yet again, that there is a difference between current caretaker, which is a department policy which sets you up for an adoption process, and caregiver relationship for the intervener purpose. They are two separate things, but oftentimes, as we talk about it, people are all jumbling them up, and I think that's kind of the inherent conflict as well. Needless to say, that's part of why we need to keep going down a path of saying, let's line everything up so that we have legislative intent, legislative direction, and department policy that really follows more of a linear process, and so it's very clear as to what we are doing. So, as you already heard, Senate Bill 815 four years ago, changed it to the 6 months, went down to 6 months, and the department supports the House Bill 2050 at this time to actually move it back to 12 months. And I'd only like to identify a couple areas that we alluded to a little bit earlier. In part is that lining these time frames up really allows us to consistently follow through with some of the treatment models that are out there for some of our families. So mother or father going to drug treatment, and they need some time to first of all, accept the fact that they're going into treatment, get into treatment, get engaged in treatment, and all knowing that their child is safe with our foster parents and being well cared for, and they need to be able to have that ability to focus on their treatment and get better. And so when we start looking at treatment that takes several months in order for it to really start taking hold of families, really 12 months is that period of time where we are going back into the court, having permanency hearings, making some decisions about what is a long-term plan for these children. So moving this back to 12 months really supports treatment modalities that are out there as well within our system, as well as what you heard earlier around Senate Bill 414 that we commented about really was the piece about relative and preference for relative placements. That statute that changed about really requiring us to tell the judge about our diligent efforts towards relative placements, it is about a preference for relatives or a caregiver. And so when this statute then comes in conflict with that one, potentially you have a foster parent who would have a caregiver relationship status at court and a relative at 6 months. Potentially then we're required to look at placement with both of those. So grandma, aunt, uncle is going up against a relative at that point in time because we have to report to the court about the diligent efforts for placement under those provisions. So really, we believe that moving it back to 12 months is one where it provides that consistency throughout. The other two pieces that I would say is that this is really about understanding what Mr. Don Darlin spoke about, is understanding what is the problem with some of our cases, and is there advocacy issues that we need to deal with in a different way. And it is not always about legislating a specific rule out there on one or two cases, but it is about going in and trying to address the issue. Why is this happening and what is the problem? And I think there's a lot of work that's been done over the last 4 to 6 years about moving in that direction. I would also draw attention, or the committee's attention then, too, is that there are actually three statutes out there that have varying roles and responsibilities. So the one we're talking about here is really ORS 419B116, which is the intervener, and asking to move to 12 months. There is also then the one we noted that changed for Senate Bill 414, which is the 419B192, and that's the other piece. And then a third one that we haven't spoken about yet is the requirement that Don spoke about, and it's 419B875, and that's the one that provides the rights for foster parents to be in court, to be heard in court. Judges have to acknowledge them in court and hear their opinions in court. So there's nothing in this current bill that precludes a foster parent from still being there. Our responsibility to notify a foster parent to be to court, talk with a judge, and really advocate on the best interest of the child. And so it really, in my opinion, it does not really impact House Bill 2050, and therefore we really support moving the time frame back to 12 months for the intervener status. That's all I would have to say, and I'd be happy to answer any other questions.
Any questions of any of these witnesses? Representative Cowan.
I think we're getting my answer here. I guess what I've been struggling to understand, and I may get the words wrong, so please just
where in this process the current provider of care, foster parent, whatever, reaches the status that they are on equal consideration with a blood relative for adoption consideration. And then I think I got confused in the rest of the conversation when we got to intervener, because I would always picture the person who has the responsibility for day-to-day care of a child to be in a position where the court would hear them and listen to them about the various situations. So from what you just said, and whether I get caretaker or relationship or whatever word wrong, this bill is basically talking about when that foster parent is considered on an equal status for adoption, and or does it get to address the question of when they can be considered a voice in the court proceedings?
Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, no, it does not. It does not put them on the same parallel. Intervener status really is merely that a foster parent currently, after having a child in their home for 6 months, may go to the court and file a motion and say, I'd like to intervene. I'd like to become a party to the case. And that's as far as it goes. Once they become a party to the case, they get all the information about families. They get anything that I would send potentially to Mr. Baker as far as the attorney, as far as DHS, I would provide to that foster parent. They become a party to the case, have a seat at the table, can get attorneys if they want. It just becomes another person involved in the case at that point in time. It really has nothing to do with are they on the same level. Okay, the one piece I would say, though, and it maybe gets to the heart of your question, and you'll correct me, is really two things. One is the current statute does have a different degree for those infants, but it's for the non-related foster parent. So we're really only talking about, the only piece we're really changing is a non-related foster parent. So a relative still has that. The current statute does allow for children that are under 6 months of age that you don't have to wait 6 months to get that status for a relative. They can do it earlier. And that part of the statute has not changed. So it addresses that. But what we're really talking about is this intervener status is separate and aside from the ability that we have to make determination that, yes, we are ready to move forward with a permanency plan for this child. We want this foster parent to make that placement decision. We want to move into the placement. So we can still move in that direction regardless whether it's intervener status or not by the foster parent. So we can still place with that foster parent on a permanent basis.
Follow up. I understand the length of time with treatment modalities. I understand the search for permanency. Maybe I just need a simple definition. When the line says increases time required to establish non-related foster parent caregiver relationship, what does the establishment of non-related foster parent caregiver relationship mean?
Sir, Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, a non-related, in our system we have foster parents, and 70% of them are, 70% of our children are placed with a non-relative.
I understand.
30% are placed with relatives.
I understand.
So this intervener status really is talking about moving for that 70% of the children who are placed with a non-relative, such as Mr. Darlin talked about.
Yes.
It's only his ability to actually intervene on a case. It's not on if grandma is the foster parent for the child.
No, I understand
okay.
that, and I'm sorry to interrupt you, but
no,
I'm just trying to clearly understand what I know what a non-relative
okay.
foster parent is.
Okay.
I had one young man in my home for 30 days on his way to another placement. If there had been a court proceeding, I probably would not have been considered of an intervener status. I had another young lady in my home that was working her way through a pregnancy and so was there for just a little bit longer than a month. And at some point in this month of time, then, had there been a court proceeding, I wasn't seeking to adopt the child. Just I would have had a somewhat higher level of intervener status in talking to the judge. And is that what we're talking about here?
Chair Tomei and Representative Cohen. That's the difference. The right to be heard versus intervention rights.
Yes or no will be
they're
fine.
Significant. Or more access, I should say, under intervention. Yes.
Any other questions? Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you for coming today.
You.
We really appreciate it. I think
that as a result of my questions, Aaron was really trying to say something.
Aaron, did you want to intervene here?
Looked like she was trying to jump out of her chair. So,
Chair Tomei, Representative Cowan, thank you for indulging me. I apologize. I feel like maybe wasn't totally clear from the previous comments, which I think all made excellent points and illustrated the complexity of this, is that there is a relationship, and historically we have understood that our definition in our rule around current caretaker and the qualification that we've established that you have to have been a provider for 6 months to achieve current caretaker status in an adoption proceeding, that our definition in our rule on that adoption side derives from the definition in this particular statute that Hospital 2050 is designed to address around the intervener definition of caregiver relationship. So one of the questions I feel like was being asked is there are really two different things we've been talking about. One is, can a foster parent speak at a court proceeding? And because of the great work of the Foster Parent Association and the Foster Parent Bill of Rights, the law now says yes. Even without formal party status, a foster parent can speak to the court about what is happening in the home with a foster child. Sometimes, as Mr. Darlin pointed out, sometimes I think that doesn't always happen, but there is in law that right for that to happen. The second thing is, when can a foster parent formally intervene as a party and have an elevated legal right to information, to participate in the court proceeding? And that's what is being changed in this bill. And then the third issue is, what does the agency rule say happens with respect to a current caretaker, and the consideration that we give to a current caretaker in an adoption proceeding as compared to a relative. And as I said, our understanding is that the department's authority around our definition at the adoption end really derives from the definition that is given in statute around the intervener issue. Now, that's been our historic understanding, and we can certainly seek some additional clarification around that. I think the other thing I would just want to point out around the issue of flexibility, I really want to be sure that the committee hears from us, one, that we really value and appreciate the fact that many Oregonians become foster parents, have attachments to children, and lovingly care for them on a daily basis. And our position on the bill is in no way intended to reflect that we do not appreciate that. I think the other point around the issue of flexibility that has been raised is that we would not be precluded from considering on the adoption side of the work. The department would not be precluded from considering a foster parent as a potential permanent placement for a child, even at 6 months, were our rule to change and extend that current caregiver status to 12. So for a young infant who maybe has been in the home for a very short period of time, and if in fact it's determined very early on that the biological family is not going to be able to safely parent that child and we move into an adoption proceeding, a foster parent still could be considered as a permanent adoptive resource even if they haven't achieved current caretaker status. So I really appreciate the opportunity, and hopefully I added some clarification to the conversation.
Thank you so much.
That was helpful. Thank you.
Great. Any further questions of Ms. Kelly Seal? Okay. With that, I will close the public hearing on what is our House Bill 2050. Anything else for the good of the order? All right, we'll close with, yes. Oh, yes, please.
No.
You're going to wear your red trousers on Friday?
No, I have a different surprise.
Oh! You haven't seen his red trousers.
Red trousers?
Oh, yes.
Very Euro.
Yes. Very Euro. Thank you. All right, so we'll close the public hearing. Or we close the...
We are adjourned.
Thank you. We are adjourned. Thank you.